Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
an interview with the producers of Rumours and Tusk.
Wow, Jim, that's amazing. You mean these guys were in the same room with Stevie Nicks?
Of course, they were producing the records. Patrick, are you okay? Well, he fainted.
We just broke the fourth wall.
Okay, special episode today of Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Patrick, from time to time, we do patron episodes where people who are supporters of the show get to come on and
yep.
They can pick the topic, talk about whatever they want. And lately, some of these listeners have invited others to participate in these, people that they think would be good for the show and they want to talk to. And our friend Mike Wagner, whose turn it is today, did just that. So
amazing.
I'm going to turn this over to Mike, and Mike will introduce our special guest for this episode.
I'll be happy to do that. With us today are Ken Kelly and Hernan Rojas. They wrote a book called Get Tusked, which is about the making of the album Tusk. Ken was one of the co-producers on Tusk, and Hernan was one of the engineers. And anybody who hangs around me and talks music for more than 10 minutes has to listen to me blather on about my love of that album. So I finished reading the book and I loved it. And I just reached out to Ken and said, hey, would you like to come on? And he said, sure. He said, we should invite Hernan as well. And I said, fantastic. Hernan was the co-author with him. What I thought we would start with is because it played such an important role. And I should also mention, Ken was the producer on Rumours as well.
Right. So two classic Fleetwood Mac albums.
A great example of being in the right place at the right time.
We want to hear all about that.
I thought we would start and talk just a little bit about Rumours, because I know Ken also is working on a project for the refurbishment of the recording studio, which they recorded Rumours in, which was in Sausalito. You want to talk a little bit about that, Ken, to start with?
Sure. We recorded Rumours in 76. We spent about 4 months up at the Sausalito record plant and then finished it down in LA at Wally Heider's. And then, recently about 10 years ago, I found the Sausalito record plant was sitting there, for sale and abandoned, and wasn't abandoned, but I mean, it was just for sale. Nobody was using it. So I decided that I had seen too many great studios disappear. So I thought, let me try to see if I can save it. Not thinking I could raise the money and do everything like that. But anyway, it took me about 10 years to go through all the blockades that just had come up around the building. And we finally escrow on it. March 30th this year, in the midst of COVID, almost didn't get it because the COVID almost closed the banks down. But now we're refurbishing it. We're going to bring it back to its full glory, 4 recording studios and 2 analog studios, 2 digital studios. And we're going to have some museum there, paying homage to the rock and roll scene in the Bay Area and music in general. Try to spread the word that music is cool and the kids should get involved in it while they're locked up in their house, quarantined.
Well, so tell us a little bit about your memories working at the record plant.
Well, I was about 29 years old, and I was there when Stevie Nicks burst into the room and said, I just wrote the Dreams. I'm really in love with it. And we have a spot on the floor where she actually wrote Dreams at. So, it was lucky for me. I was hired as an engineer, and I decided to make great sound. I mean, I loved being a sound engineer. I loved working on the sounds, and they loved me doing it. They just said, sure, if you want to make me better, sound better, go for it. So I would spend days or hours making Lindsey's guitar sound like a piano or whatever, and just backward sounds and amazing sounds. And basically, to that end, we started, the sound started coming out, the rumor sound, and everybody kind of got behind it. And it seemed to just, one thing led to another, and everything kept getting better. The songs kept getting better, and they had new ideas. And, so eventually they said, you know, you're actually doing not engineer's work. You're doing more than that. They said, you're being a producer. And when I say I mean Richard Dashett. Richard Dashett was a co-engineer, co-producer with me. But they kind of gave us a raise and made us producers, which didn't really know that. I mean, I knew what it meant. It meant that if I might get some a percentage of the sales, but what records ever do good, you know? So, yeah, I thought, great, I'm going to get 25 cents, you know? But thank you very much for the offer. So... Anyway, then we made the record, yeah. And then a year and a half later, we started building our own studio to do the next album. I thought we were going to do the next Rumors 2.
Well, let me stop. Let me ask you real quick. I know we want to talk about Tusk, but I want to ask this question to you about Rumors, because one of the things I find fascinating about that album, I mean, first off, I think you did all right on that percentage deal. So let's just say that. So good move there. But the record today, Rumors, I think, you know, it lasts, or it people still love it today, you know, obviously because of the songs and the songwriting and the performances. But I think there's also something to the sound of that album that it doesn't sound dated at all. Like, you can listen to it today. It sounds very fresh. You know, it sounds like records that are produced today. And I just wonder do you have any insight into that? Like, was there anything that you did that makes it that way?
Well, the sound, every sound was amazing, I think. And it was because we recorded analog. You know, I don't know if you know, if you want to talk about engineering, but analog is, you know, right above the volume control on an analog console is the tone controls. And the tone controls was important to sound shape, to shape the sound, to protect early on, to protect the transmitters for in early radio. So we started using it to, like I said, like the Beatles say, you know, we make this piano sound like a guitar, or just do these things. And when you do turn the knobs, and you get an excitement out of the artists, they sit there go, "What'd you do to my snare, man? It sounds good." And they start getting like loosey goosey. It sounds good. I mean, I want to play some sexy parts on over it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so creativity just comes pouring out when you kind of squeeze the instrument and make it sound better. And, so that's my take on how come it's good. And
okay. So, Mike, I know you really want to talk about Tusk. You mentioned it's one of your favorite albums, and can you just give us a sense of like what it is about that album that you love so much?
First off is, I don't mean to be, this is genuine. I just love the sound of the album. I just love the sound. The guitars sound amazing. The bass and drums, when I know that we'll probably get into this because Lindsey re-recorded some of the bass and did his own, but when Mick and John are playing on there, it just sounds fantastic. And Sarah is one of the greatest songs. If you ask me my top five songs, Sarah's in there. And Ken wrote in the book, and I think he's absolutely right, the most gorgeous song in the Fleetwood Mac catalog is Beautiful Child, which I've played. I have no many idea how many times I played that song. That's absolutely one of my favorites. So I just returned to it. I've returned to it over and over and over the last, what is it now, 40 years, right?
I was going to say, you notice that Lindsey, I think it's very interesting that Lindsey, on his own songs, really made the guitars just really grunge. He really wanted to make them distorted and nasty. And the vocals, anything on his songs, he just wanted to be kind of raggedy sounding. And so he made that decision somewhere inside his mind that he needed to his audience to hear a different side of him. And
right.
But I thought it was interesting after kind of reflecting back on it while we were writing the book that all of the girls' songs are just lush and beautiful.
Right. So, exactly.
And I'm surprised that he didn't actually say to them, I'm going to make them really dirty. They maybe he did. And they said, try it, buddy. And you won't live, you know, see the end of the album.
So did you have to this is a question for both of you. Did you have to approach the songs differently based on whose songs they were?
Sure.
I mean, that's not like most bands, right?
Sure. It probably is like the Eagles or anybody.
Mm, okay.
I mean, you know, you have your musicians there and they have their musicianship. So and I don't play guitar. So I had to rely on Lindsay to play the guitars that he heard in his mind. And I just think it's up to them. But, you know, Ernan has a whole take on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the White Album that I think Lindsay was really listening to it and studying it, where, you know, there would be this different approach to each one of them. There were moments that Lindsay wanted, you know, nobody in the studio. There were moments that he wanted everywhere in the studio. There were moments that he was going head to heads with Ken, you know, and one of the opening lines of the book when Ken says, when he says, hey, let's make this guitar sound great. And he says, no, do the contrary, right? Go all the other way, right? And then Ken describes it as an old tire, you know, a tuba sound on a beautiful, you know, guitar. That was pretty much, you know, the whole way, and as there were moments, magical moments that you describe in Sarah, where those guitars are just, you know, there's so many amazing passes there, and things that we did, you know, that we had tried before, but somehow on Sarah, you know, they just all came together. You know, Kent's trick of putting, for example, an ECM50 microphone, you know, this little real tiny microphone, directional microphone, a Sony underneath the strings of the electric guitar, and you know, if you think about it, you know, there's no sound there, right? But there is. There's enough sound that if you you know, combine it with a whole bunch of other things, you know, maybe his own fat box that Ken had, plus, you know, maybe going through directly into the board, plus, you know, I don't know, a stack of Marshalls or whatever, you know. Oh, and the Leslie rotating speaker inside the chamber, the echo chamber, you know. So it was always, you know, searching for all these, you know, combinations. Sometimes they were beautiful. Sometimes they were, you know, like the song, you know, what makes you think you're the one, you know, if it's in your face. It's like, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Ernan, you wrote a beautiful passage in the, there was like a sort of a long series in the book, how you really helped bring Sarah to life, actually. And you talk about how, I think a lot of listeners would be surprised that even though Stevie Nicks is probably, well, not probably, she is the biggest star out of Fleetwood Mac, but she had a harder time bringing her songs to the band and getting them on the album. And you wrote a lovely passage about how you sort of encouraged her to bring that song forward and, you know, worked with, Ken and, Richard, and then brought on the band members. You want to talk about that a little bit? I found that a really interesting, aspect of it. Cause it's like, you hear Sarah and you think, oh yes, that has to be on the album, right?
Wait a minute, baby. Stay with me. Said you give me life, but you never told me about the fire.
You know, when I heard the cassette, I remember the demos. Stevie had this method that she had two ghetto blasters, two cassette decks, you know, the old type that had microphones built in, right? And so she would do a pass with a guitar or a piano and her voice, and then she would play it on one cassette and record on another one and put some, you know, maybe some harmonies or whatever, or a tambourine. So she had one of those. And I remember when she showed me all these demos, I said, that's a song that you know, we need to cut, we need to recut it, and let's take advantage of a Sunday. I think it was a Sunday, you know, that we never took breaks, really. I mean, it was really one of those days. And on the other hand, you know, there was a whole bunch of emotional issues that I didn't know about, but then I started learning later on. You know, she had just finished her relationship with Mick. And that was a whole, you know, universe of different, you know, stories, you know, extra stories, other relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So on the other hand, I felt, and this is something that I felt then, that the band resented that a lot of the attention was on her, you know, from the press or maybe some fans or whatever, you know, and the song Dreams and et cetera. So and plus, she was, because of the breakup with Mick, she was completely, you know, down on everything, on everything you can think of. So I think that was part of getting her out of there, you know, of that dark corner, of telling her, hey, you know, let's fight for the song. And that's how the process started. And it was very magical because Ken, who was the first one to hear the demo, right away, you know, Ken said, hey, you know, there's something here. But the mission was hard because, you know, we had to get Mick in there. He did the first pass with brushes, get John in there one night, you know, and then obviously, you know, the big moment, it was like going in front of the Pope or something, you know. hey, you know, leaning down or whoever, you know, Buddha or somewhere, you know, Sir Lindsay leaning, you know, can we? And he loved it. So he went on, and then the whole process started, you know, cutting the 2-inch tape, because it was, I remember the original take was like 20 minutes or 18 minutes. Then it went down to 16, then to 14, then to 11, and so, you know, and such. But I have the multitrack, sorry, and that Ken copied me on Pro Tools, that I listen to it often because there's so many beautiful things there. I mean, If you would have to remix that song today, you know, Ken, you would be faced with a tremendous task of of making decisions. You know, although the decisions you made in the day they was mixed, it was fine, but today may be another perspective. Who knows?
It'd be fun. It'd be fun to take a different look at it.
Now, as I remember how that was recorded, I think you said you had a tack piano in the studio, and then Stevie played one of those. Because if you listen to it, you pan. There's two pianos that are panned right on either side, which gives it that really amazing sound. And then sort of Lindsay's guitars, and that's, I love the phrase that Ken uses, how he calls it sound shaping, right? And you have Lindsay's guitars kind of floating in and out, and then, you know, Mick and John like holding down the middle. It's just all just fantastic.
Yeah, the tack piano, the original run was, you know, from the demo that it was cut on the same studio, so it had the same board, same microphones, everything, 2-inch tape on the Studers. But then Ken said, hey, you know, let's keep that piano. And then he invited Christine to play the same piano, and it was a little bit out of tune, as you can see, as you can listen. And then obviously Stevie was playing all over the place because she was just, you know, it was just a demo. And the only reference we had, it was, I think it was one of those Roland or Korg drum boxes. You know, the old ones that had like foxtrot, you know, jazz, blues, rock, that you just hit a whole bunch of buttons, right? So, mm-hmm. so, and Christine was more, you know, on the pocket. So, so it creates that effect, and it was discrete mono on each side. It's a wonderful thing.
So another thing I wanted to ask you guys about was, when you, you know, Tusk is legendary in that it took what, 12, 13 months to, from start to finish to record. Right. And it didn't see, and it seems like there's just layers and layers and re-records and all lots of work. And it also seems like Lindsay sometimes would come in and then other times he just wouldn't be there. Is that kind of how it worked, or were they all there all the time, or how did that work, that, you know, day to day, was every day sort of different? I mean, I'm just kind of curious your take on that.
So yeah, we were there. I mean, it's when you do an album that takes a year to do, you know, it becomes you get into habit really quick. And so 3 weeks in, we were starting to, you know, everybody knows where they're going to sit every day and what their favorite drink is. And so everybody shows up for work basically. And then Lindsay started pulling back, and he didn't really tell us what was going on. And I thought, I sometimes blame us because we didn't, I think we could have said, hey, Lindsay, I get it. You don't know where you want to go really, but you want to basically experiment and let's help you do that. We'll help you as much as we can, but he didn't, he just kept it a secret, and he just become more of a recluse. I think also that he was getting pushed by Mick to don't get too wild. But so he just, sometimes he would not show up for 3 weeks at a time, and he move all the equipment home to his house, where, so he didn't want Mick and Lindsay and Mick and any of us being involved. Basically, he took everything home so he could do it his way. And then he brought it back and we had to live with it. So it's kind of his way of getting even with us.
So what would the band do when Lindsay was gone? Would they work on other stuff or do overdubs, or what would they do when Lindsay was off doing his own thing?
Sure. I mean, sometimes Christine would go visit Dennis Wilson, you know, if they knew there was no work going on. Sometimes Stevie would party, bring it with her friends. Sometimes we would just do work. But I mean, we tried to detail it in the book because we had everything pretty much on a calendar. So you can see when and what we did or didn't do.
And there were really no moments of pause. You know, there were no moments where we would sit in the studio and say, hey, you know, what are we going to do today? Because, for example, you know, we would do Ken, you know, who was who had this very good connection with Christine. He would be, you know, leading Christine's vocal sessions. I remember that, for example. Or maybe we could go into tambourines with Mick, you know, or maybe overdub bass, you know, keyboards. There was always something to do, always.
You mentioned overdubbing bass. So I wanted to ask you about how John was during the recording of Husky. Obviously, John was there from the beginning, and he played a huge role in the early days, and then he was pretty much, in essence, sort of set aside in his own band. It seemed that's kind of how I took it. Obviously, there's songs where he really contributed, and whenever he plays, it's awesome, right? I mean, like, just his bass on Think About Me is just fantastic, right? So, but did he have a lot of time sitting around, or?
Oh yeah.
How did he handle?
He had tons of time. He had way too much time, which it would lead him to indulging in things that weren't really good for him to indulge in, but he, you know, it started back in Rumors. Lindsay started taking John's bass away, like on Secondhand News. One day, Lindsay just said, can we erase John's bass? And we said, what? No, can't erase. John's bass was beautiful. It was like, boom, 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 boom. just a lot of notes, a lot of movement. And Lindsey wanted the bass to be boom, 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 very right down the middle. So Lindsey's mind, it gave him room to put these other acoustic guitars in. They went ching, ding, ching, ching. Anyway, so once, and Lindsey did that when John was on vacation. So once John was confronted with it, he was really upset. I remember that Mick said something like, well, you're going to have to, you know, good boy, Johnny, you're going to, you know, go good. A good one being the team player. And then Lindsey turned around to Mick and said, oh yeah, Mick, I want you to change some parts too. And so Lindsey actually played some of Mick's drum parts that Mick couldn't play. I mean, Lindsey in his mind heard these spastic drums where they would just go boom, 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 boom. I'm like, go your own way. And Mick was, he was too gentle, I guess. Mick was just did his own thing. So come around to Tuss, that started happening a lot. And there was a picture of John and Mick sitting there with their gaffer's tape over their mouth, and their John's bass was in the trash can.
Right.
The commentary of them that, you know, thanks a lot, Lindsey. So, but Lindsey, I mean, John played some beautiful bass on there, but he had to, particularly on Lindsey's songs, Lindsey did his own bass and John didn't. So, right.
Did you guys ever hear from the record company when all this was going on? They were just, you sort of had a blank check because Rumors was so successful.
Right. Rumors were still going great. And they just thought, hell. I mean, Rumors was still, I think we were in the eighth month of recording when Rumors hit, what was it, Rhiannon or the previous album hit top 10 or something. And so the record company was just sitting back there, you know, so pleased with themselves.
Right. Counting all the money.
And I don't really remember them being around very much. I'm sure they started coming around towards the end with Tusk. I think, you know, they got involved when we talked about doing a double album, and we were told that they weren't going to do a double album. Mick had decided that we would do two single albums. And when you slid the second single album in, it would complete the artwork.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought, this is great. Great idea. And then you're selling two records that sell for $7.98. And, you know, but record company said, no, we had a better idea. Let's take all the money and run. So they went with a double album. Then at the same time, when RKO Radio got a copy of Stevie's demo tapes and released it, and everybody got pissed off.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Ernie, you want to do anything else on that?
Yeah, I remember the day that Warner's showed up. You remember that it was announced like a few days before? And it's actually, the scene is in the book. And Lindsey, you know, commanded us that we make some rough mixes, but based on his songs that he wanted for them to, he wanted to really confront them, really. I mean, he wanted to hit them, you know, hard on their faces. And so we had like this assembly of songs, mainly from Lindsey. I think there was one or two from Christina, a couple from Stevie. They were all mixed really rough, you know, really, you know, grungy. And I remember Lindsey and Richard smoking, you know, filling the whole control room in Studio D with pot. So that when they would come in, they would be completely, you know, stoned. And I remember that instance very well because I was looking at their faces, you know. What are they thinking? You know, what's happening inside their mind? It was not Rumors at all. You know, it was one of those nights.
That's amazing.
I don't know what they thought about it, but I mean, they had to have been just because we worked so hard, because Lindsey made them all the songs so grungy that we tried to change the running order so that it would soften the blow. It'd start with one of Christine's songs, and then maybe you kind of sneak one of Lindsay's in. I don't know. I pretty well thought they were going to pull the plug, and Lindsay was at the same time saying, "If you don't do what I say, I'm quitting the band, and everything will be done." So, you know, he was really a dick.
Yeah, and you know,
I have other 4-letter words. That
there you go.
It's a family.
Would you like
podcast,
to put a finer yeah. point on that?
I know one that starts with a T. But we're not going to say that. And you know, there was a moment that Lindsay pushed Ken out of the studio. I mean, it's also in the book there.
Yep.
And
yep.
I remember that, and it was horrible because, you know, my allegiance was with Ken, but Lindsay said, "Hey, you know, you have to stay. You know, we're going to record without Ken, and we're going to go ahead." And I think it was like a week or so. You remember, Ken, that instance? And I think it was the beginning of your relationship with Diane too, and the Malibu slides, you know, that road was cut. So it was a good timing for you too.
Yeah, I said good luck.
Right. Yeah. You know, during those days, I remember he did some of the drum tracks where he tripled or quadrupled the snare and the kick drum and the toms and the bass lines, trying to emulate, you know, what Lennon did on some of the songs, with a big difference, although, you know, where, you know, Lennon would still have a producer and engineer that would, you know, clean up all this mess, you know. In his case, I remember him, you know, reaching over Ken in the console. Even when we were mixing, he was reaching over. You remember, Ken?
Yeah.
I don't want to remember, says Ken.
Yeah. What kind of setup did Lindsay have at home when he would, you know, take these things home? Did he have a pretty sophisticated setup there, or did you guys ever see it or know anything about that?
Oh yeah, we saw it. It was a reel to reel. I mean, he had a multi-track, and he had some cheap microphones, or regular mics, and I don't remember what kind of console he had.
I think he had like a real basic MCI or something like that. Real, and a whole bunch of like preamps, you know, Pultec. I think he had a 4-track, a half-inch 4-track, an Ampex. And eventually he got an MCI 2-inch 16-track.
Okay.
Where he cut some of the stuff, you know. And there's a scene in the book that Ken, you know, sort of narrates it very well when, you know, we're like in this Halloween party that Lindsay, you know, was famous for. And so we were going around the house. Ken was going around the house. You know, there was all these scenes happening. It was quite wild. And suddenly Ken, you know, he tells the story like, "I went into the bathroom and I tripped on all these cables." And there in the corner of the bathroom was all this stuff, you know, the 4-track, the 24-track, and everything in the floor. So he was recording right against the, you know, the the tiles. He was trying to get that John Lennon sound.
Yeah. That's amazing.
My first experience with Tusk was as a kid and seeing the video for the song Tusk on MTV, right? And so the my memory serves, I think it got, you know, a fair amount of airplay on MTV. It might have been the first big, you know, Fleetwood Mac video, I think, that because of the timing when MTV hit. But of course you see the was it the USC marching band in that video? Yep. Is that the same band that you guys actually recorded? How did that and how did you do that? That seems like, you know, such a foreign thing to put on a, you know, rock and roll record, right?
This is another one of Mick's ideas. He thought, well, if we could start using these marching bands, apparently every city has a marching band. And he said, well, this would be great. When we go on tour, we'll get the local marching bands to come in there, and that'll give us community reach. And you know, so he thought it would be great. So when we started to record it, we had prepared a track. It was a warm-up song that they had.
Yeah. Right. I think I've heard that demo before where it's like dun 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 da, dun right. dun dun. That's what they would. That's, it would jam as a warm up for the for a sound check, right?
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And so then Lindsay just once Mick said that, Lindsay got into it and started building up drum rhythm tracks and screaming, you know, wild screaming and animal sounds. And but anyway, he built this cacophony of sounds up, and then we were ready to go to Dodger Stadium, and I hadn't really given it much thought. I had the Wally Heider remote truck showing up, figured we'd just record it and have the marching band play their part and be done with it. But we start playing, they start playing, and they said, by the way, we're a marching band. We can only play when we march. No. You got to stand there, you know? And no, we can't stand there. So Arnon and I were like, what the heck are we going to do? And how do we record a marching band moving when we didn't have enough headphones for 180 people or whatever it was, 100 people? We didn't have any ability to do it. So we went to, I guess, shotgun mics. And but we had to give the conductor, or the band leader, the only headphones. So he basically conducted the band, their sheet music, and we recorded them with movement. But I remember we when we were mixing it, we had two tapes, one the USC tape and one our cacophony tape. And we had to kind of play the USC tape with the VSO, slowing it up, slowing down and speeding up a little bit to fit in with the track because it got out of sync.
Was there ever a point here, Ken, where you just said, like, this is insane? Why are we doing this?
Yeah. it was, I mean, my whole point of writing the book was I kept finding I was going back and bitching, basically just bitching about almost being a captive, like, you know, okay, yeah, if you don't do this, you're going to be fired. And how we all were living under that thumb of oppression. And I really hated it. Arnon was the only guy. He kept, Ken, come on. You know, it was great. Remember all the fun we had. But so it was really hard for me to write this book because I kept wanting to go negative. I didn't want to, but anyway, thanks to him, he made it a happy book.
Arnon, isn't there a story where I was rereading and I may have missed this part, but wasn't there some at one point where you cut a tape wrong?
Yeah,
and they were going to fire you, or well,
yes.
You want to tell that story?
Well, it was I would say the third month maybe when we had some of the basic tracks, and it was one of Lindsay's songs. It was one of those days, you know, that we had the band to rest, and we were just doing security copies for everything. Because obviously, you know, there was so much invested here and there were so many takes of everything that we were continuously making security copies and storing them. And some of them even would be shipped away to some other vaults. And in this case, we were in the control room doing a whole bunch of security copies. And it was, you know, a moment for one of Lindsay's song. And one of the roadies, Greg, who passed away, I'm not sure when, he was a really alive guy, you know, comedian, funny, etc. And he kept passing joints around the room while we were making copies. I said, hey, you know, Greg, I have to stay concentrated. And you know, somehow he managed to get one hit on me. And it was one of those, you know, Northern California that really hits right away. And for 1 second, I got the two remote controls were exactly the same, right? The two machines were exactly the same, the two Studers. And I got the wrong remote control on the wrong position. So I put the red buttons right on one remote, except, you know, instead of the reverse thing. But it was an instant thing. It was like a second or two that I went like, right? And stopped it. And right. I erased the first, I don't know what, a second, a half a second of one right. of the 40 takes of this song that I'm trying to remember which one it was. It, you know, it's not that funny, one of those. So I tell Lindsay and Ken, and they say, you know, hey, you know, what are we going to do? So we were always keeping a reference quarter inch of everything that we were doing in the studio. So we had like a rough mix of that. And we inserted that second on each one of the 24 tracks wow. on the beginning of the song, but it was a perfect splice. So if you hear it, you know, with the whole, you know, all the tracks up, it would sound the same, right? But if you wanted to solo the beginning of the song, you wouldn't hear the bass or the drum, you know, the guitar for 1 second.
And
Lindsay, for some reason, you know, a couple of days after that, he said, hey, you know, let's check this song, you know, let's go back and check, you know, because we had so many takes and so many songs, and he wanted to hear that take. Like I said, there were many takes. And so he starts going back and forth, and he was managing the tape board, you know, I mean, the remote control. He was going the solos, he queuing and everything. And suddenly, you know, he catches on this trick, and he just goes bananas. I mean, screams, you know, throws everything away, you know, and tells Ken and Richard, hey, you guys, what have you guys done to me? You know, blah, 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 you tricked me, blah, 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 screaming. And then he said, who did this? And I didn't want to get, you know, Ken or Richard in trouble. So I said, sorry, Lindsay, it was me. And it was just a split of a second. It doesn't matter. You're fired. Get out of here. It was one of the most horrible moments in my life, let me tell you.
I bet.
But Richard and Ken, became my defenders. And Lindsay, I guess, cooled down and passed out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not for nothing did he, not too long later, make a solo album called Go Insane. So.
Right. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I would say that it was not only a going insane time, you know, moment, 13 month, but it was also, you know, a roller coaster of emotions, of frustrations, of happy moments, of everything. You know, it was like an ecosystem with that, you know, that everything happens, you know, like in any given moment in life, you know, in a war, maybe in a platoon or in a company, you know, when they're at a moment that they're launching, you know, the new iPhone or whatever. But this was 13 months of it, you know.
Yeah.
It was so intense. Plus, you know, there were all these things happening, you know, emotional things happening too. Cutting romance, ending romance, beginning romance, and obviously the frustration of people like John with a scratch bass on the trash can.
So we talked about Lindsay, obviously, a lot, and the other members of the band, but we really haven't talked about Christine. She also has some really tremendous songs on this album. And it seems like, reading the book, that one of the things I noticed was that there was more of group unity behind Christine's songs than most of the other ones. Maybe that's just my perception of it, but it seems like, you know, like they were all playing on Think About Me, and they all played on Brown Eyes, and they all played on Honey High, and but a couple other songs. Talk about some of her songs and how it was to work with her.
Well, Christine was great. You know, she was one of the guys, so you know, when she would do a song, it'd be almost the same as any one of the guys doing it. You know, straight rock and roll verses and choruses and piano parts. And Mick didn't have to do any tricks with it. He just played regular straight head drums. So did John. She was just a trooper, right? The problem with Chris, with Stevie, was that she's Lindsay's ex. So Lindsay was always ticked off with something. So Christine didn't have that issue at all. Christine was just one of the guys, played straight rock and roll. And Lindsay didn't have much of a problem, but he never tried to do anything grungy with her, I don't think. So I don't understand why he did that on his own. and insisted. I remember Mick said something about, you know, Lindsey, the Fleetwood Mac fans can only take so much experimentation. You know, and I think he probably said some way like, you know, so it doesn't matter whether you quit the band, if they might quit us. So keep it in mind. So, and I don't know how much of that. I'd love to get an interview with Mick where he could tell us what went down behind the scenes. Because to me and Aaron on, it was our battle, you know, and we had the kind of, we had Christine supporting us, we had Stevie supporting us, but we kind of were leading the charge, I think.
You know, there's a great example of what Ken is saying. If you listen, for example, to Think About Me or Brown Eyes or any of Christine's songs, where, you know, everything is pretty much in place, right? Production-wise, sound-wise, structure-wise, everything. And then you listen to Sisters of the Moon, and that, you know, really shows the lack of interest that Lindsey had on creating a great song. I mean, he never added his magic touch to that song.
I'm just curious to get your guys' long-term perspective on this, because, you know, how did you feel about the reception to the Tusk album when it was released? And then my follow-up to that is, how do you look back on it now? Do you think it's gained some greater appreciation over time?
I think it got a rough shake. And, you know, like I said, when the RKO basically boycotted our band, I mean, boycotted the songs and wouldn't play them at all. And with a combination of the Tusk coming out as a double album at $20 or something, people were listening on the radio to this crazy Tusk song, and that's all I could get because the other songs weren't available. And I think I was panicked, like, oh no, this is going the wrong way. I had just gotten married, mm-hmm. and my best man, his toast was many Tusk sales. So, and I saw that flying away, you know. So, but now, of course, it's great. You know, and I love the sound of it. The thing that I'm really proud of in when you're making a big time record with professional studio gear, and I mean the speakers. I mean it was such a privilege for me and Hernan and Richard to hit play, and these amazing sounds came flying out at you, and you can immerse yourself in the reverb of a vocal or of a guitar part. And it was just instant gratification.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that I would like to say on Lindsey's behalf, you know, musically wise, sound wise, you know, for me, I was a little younger than Ken or Richard, and in those days, you know, of punk, of new wave, and all that. Writing the book, we discovered that Lindsey, in a way, had been a pioneer on three styles that then became very popular on alternative rock. The fact that Lindsey, you know, was really, yeah, Lindsey was a pioneer on this style called psychobilly, on this style called lo-fi, and then on cowpunk. You know, the only band that was doing cowpunk in those days were the Germs in L.A., and this other band that eventually caught up, you know, from L.A. too, it's called Suicidal Tendencies. I'm not sure if you know that band. Very important punk band, and they're still alive. So in a way, Lindsey, you know, without knowing, and, you know, with us, you know, going crazy, he was defying, you know, many things and laying new grounds for all these styles that kids, you know, would pick up, maybe by listening to Tusk, maybe not. But they were important.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for being on
Thank
our
you
show.
Guys.
We really
yeah.
appreciate this.
So fun.
Been, yeah, really fun discussion. So the book Get Tusked came out earlier this year, and everyone should go out and check out that book. All right.
Or order it online like I did during our conversation.
There you go.
So while you're listening to this podcast, you can do that.
Sales just went up.
Right? That's right.
Already,
at least by one. Yeah.
What an impact this show is already having. All right.
That's right.
All right. Ken Kelly, Aaron Rojas, thank you very much.
Thank you
so
guys.
Much for being on our podcast. We so appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you, buddy.
Thank you, guys. Bravo.
And thank you to thank you to Mike Wagner for setting this all up.
Yeah, Mike.
Fantastic. And asking great questions, too.
Absolutely.
All right. And if anyone, any listeners out there have any comments about Fleetwood Mac or Tusk, the way you can share that with us, and we'll put those on an upcoming show, is you can call 612-440-1984. There you go.
Thank you, Mike.
Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod. Mm-hmm. Once again, thank you, Ken, Aaron, and Mike. My name is Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to everyone later.
Well, if you need any guitar players to test it, Mike and I would be happy to come out there and just, when you're ready, let us know.